There had been abuse in my family, but it was mostly musical in nature.
Are you ready to get your world rocked?
Ready!
Are you ready to get your mind blown?
Do it!
1, 2, 3, 4!
Giorgio Moroder's work with Donna Summer, Blondie, and more perfectly represents the disco era. But at the time, it was the sound of the future. I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. Electronic dance pioneer Giorgio Moroder takes us through his decades-long career, and we review a new joint effort from Amy Mann and Ted Leo. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions.
This is Sound Opinions, and later on in the show, we're going to be talking to Giorgio Moroder. Now, Jim, I first encountered this name in the late 70s as a kid. I was a punk rock fan. Disco was kind of off in the corner. If you had told me then that we'd be talking about Giorgio Moroder in loving terms in 2014, I probably would have laughed at you, but you know what? The joke's on me. The guy's obviously proven his longevity.
And this is a career reassessment that is very much deserved. We're going to hear from Giorgio Moroder in a little bit, but first, some music news.
I ain't trying to be no D-boy. I love music. I'm a B-boy. Are you the undercover or the decoy? I'm heavy with the D, trouble T-boy. A pit with no muzzle. About to bust your bubble like a keloid. Too much man worm. Got me P-Nord. I'm killing instrumentals with that all so simple. Can it be boy?
That is Keep Watch, a new song from the forthcoming Wu-Tang Clan album, A Better Tomorrow. But there's another Wu-Tang Clan album coming out as well this year, Jim. It's called Once Upon a Time in Shaolin. That is where the real news is. They're only going to make one copy of Once Upon a Time in Shaolin. The idea is that they're going to take it on a tour of art galleries. They're going to charge $30 to $50 for people to come in and hear the thing. You know, there's going to be no recording allowed. It's going to be very secretive. Then they're going to auction it off. Apparently, according to RZA, the producer of the Wu-Tang Clan, they've already received one offer of $5 million for this record. The idea is to create a rare good, something that is on par with a painting or a sculpture, a piece of art. And the idea being that they feel that music has become devalued in the last decade with all this digital file sharing. They're saying, let's have a discussion about the worth of music. In a statement, they said, we hope to steer those debates toward more radical solutions and provoke questions about the value and perception of music as a work of art in today's world. It's a pretty pricey way to do it. They're going to have a lot of people talking about it. A lot of people talking about a record that most people may never hear.
Well, and looking at this thing, it comes packaged in a silver and nickel box that's all fancily engraved. It reminds me of that sinister cube in the Hellraiser movies.
Yeah, it's your national underground thunderbounce when I stop the ground. Like a million elephants, a silverback orangutan. You can't stop a train. Who wants some? Don't come unprepared. I'll leave there, but when I leave there, better be a household name. Weatherman telling us it ain't gonna rain. So now we sit in a drop top soaking wet. In a silk suit, try not to sweat. Hit somersaults without the net. But this will be the year that we won't forget. 1999.
Greg, that's a little bit of Outkast. I think they're the biggest news in this year's Coachella lineup. They will be reuniting to play in the Southern California desert on those two subsequent weekends in mid-April, the big Coachella festival. Interesting story is that several celebrities are being paid big bucks just to go to the festival, to go to a party at the festival, or to wear somebody's clothes at the festival. Lea Michele of Glee apparently is collecting $20,000 from Lacoste just to wear its clothes while she walks around the desert. And High School Musical star Vanessa Hudgens is collecting $15,000 from McDonald's to go to one of their parties there. On the other hand, there's a list of celebrities that have not yet made any money, although they've made it clear they want some. Breaking Bad actor Aaron Paul, Bad Things Happen to Jesse, he wants $15,000 and two VIP passes, but he apparently hasn't collected them yet. Where Joe Jonas of the Jonas Brothers wants $20,000 just to go to the concert. I think we should start a Kickstarter and raise some money to send Joe Jonas to the desert.
Spring was never waiting for a
last year, it ran one step ahead as we followed in the dance. MacArthur's Park is melting in the dark, all the sweet green icing.
That's the 1978 song MacArthur Park. It was Donna Summer's first number one hit and one of many successful collaborations with our guest this week, Giorgio Moroder. He's a performer, engineer, producer, and the creative genius behind many of the sounds we now identify as disco. But I don't want you to totally define his work just by that term. This was avant-garde production, and it was so ahead of its time that no less than Brian Eno, ding, there we go, could identify it as the future. Giorgio has also composed memorable scores for movies like Scarface and Midnight Express and written hit songs like Flashdance, What a Feeling, Call Me, and Take My Breath Away.
Greg, Giorgio's recently had a renaissance of sorts, collaborating with Daft Punk on their Grammy-winning album Random Access Memories. And at 73, he's still appearing at festivals including Ultra Music, Pitchfork, and Moog Fest. So, a lot to talk about, Greg. Let's welcome Giorgio Moroder to the show. Giorgio, thanks for coming on Sound Opinions.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Giorgio, let's talk about the beginnings. Everybody associates you with dance music and use of electronic instruments, but your first instrument was not a synthesized instrument, right? You picked up a guitar, is that right, when you were a boy in the 50s?
Yeah, I started to play guitar, a little bass, and I played in some for a few years in Italy in some tourist resorts, like in summertime. And then I think I was 18, 19, I became, so to say, a professional musician. I played more the bass now, and I toured Europe, every country in Europe, Switzerland, Germany. And that was great because during that time, I was able to learn a bit the recording technology, you know, by using two recorders and doing what Les Paul did, overdubbing voices. So at the end, I was a relatively good engineer and bass player. And then I decided to become a composer. That's what I always wanted to do. I quit the job as a musician and I settled first in Berlin.
So, Giorgio, what year was this exactly that you landed in Berlin?
About 67, I think.
Okay, well, you know, and the wall is dividing this city. What was it like to be a young Italian musician living in this divided Berlin at that point?
The life there was not good because with the wall, you couldn't leave the town. But I was lucky. I started with a big hit, a local big hit, with a singer called Ricky Shane. And then slowly, I was really getting tired of Berlin. And I got an offer to become a producer, a house producer for the then called Ariola, which now is BMG. Mm-hmm. And so I moved to Munich, which was much better because it was much closer to Italy.
And there was beginning to be an awakening by 68, 69, 70 in Germany, right? It would be called by the English press the Krautrock moment. Did that play into your consciousness, bands like Kraftwerk forming and Amon Dool and Can?
Faust.
Well, you know all those guys. I just know, of course, Kraftwerk and Amon Dool. I had Keith Forsey, who's my drummer, used to be part of that group. Yeah, it was like suddenly the music in Munich was starting to become more relevant. And I had several, not big, but some hits. Like one was kind of a bubblegum song, which is Looky Looky.
Ma ma ma, ba ba ma ma ma. Looky looky looky. It was only yesterday I met her walking down.
So I started to produce in English and sing in English, and that's slowly when Donna Summer came to life as a singer.
And you had a big hit, a worldwide hit in 1972. This band Chicory Tip, who I've never heard from since, had a huge hit with one of your songs called "Son of My Father," which I recall having a Moog synthesizer solo.
I had met Eberhard Schoener, who is a classical composer, who had one of the big Moog modular. I asked him if he could play some stuff, like, so I would hear what the synthesizer is doing, and he started to play me a long low note, and was slowly changing the tone, and he was mixing it through four speakers, and it was very interesting, but a little boring, actually. Then I asked the engineer if he could play me some of the other sounds which the synthesizer has, and that was a revelation, because he gave me the funny things, the nice things, the kind of synthesizers, the kind of string sounds, and I knew the sounds of the Moog quite well, because I was in love with that, with the recording of Wendy Carlos. I always thought this is an instrument which has a future, actually.
Well, tell us about how you met Donna Summer, Giorgio.
Donna was in Germany, and she was left stranded kind of in Germany, because the musical which she was performing, I think it was Hair, closed. So she got married to an Austrian guy, Helmut Sommer, and she was doing little gigs like overdubs and stuff like that. And Pete Bellotti, my co-producer, we needed some girls to sing backgrounds, and we wanted somebody who didn't have an accent. We had Donna Summer, I think Roberta Kelly, and one more girl to do the backgrounds. And we knew, you hear immediately that Donna had a great, great voice. So about 2-3 weeks later, we had the idea of doing a song called The Hostage. And that was the first song we did with Donna.
He was a hostage.
Then finally, I had the idea of doing a sex song, because I loved that French song, Je T'aime.
Oh, and by Serge Gainsbourg.
So I told Donna, whenever you have a line, an idea for a chorus lyric, tell me, and so we do it. So one day she came in and she said, okay, how about Love to Love You? Like maybe, Love to Love You, Love to Love You. And at that time I had a recording studio in Munich called Musicland, which was... I rented it out to all the big guys, the English guys like Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, Queen. But that day, by coincidence, the studio was empty. So I went down. I lived in the same building. I went down into where the studio was. And I took a guitar and I just played a little very rough demo. When she was singing, I composed some parts of it. And then I think we recorded it 2-3 days later with a nice little combo, like drum, bass, guitar. Then my music editor, my music publisher, took the rough idea to the IMIDEM, which is a music trade event in Cannes every winter. Mm-hmm. I had incredible good reaction. And in fact, some of the radio started to play it. And I think that was the real beginning of the song and of the career of Donna Summer and of my career.
Do it to me again and again. You put me in such an awful spin in a spin. In.
Well, she had a scandalous take on that song as well. I mean, there were some radio stations that wouldn't play the song because it was considered so explicit for the time.
Well, actually, I was shocked or very surprised that any radio station would play it. But the famous one was the BBC in London, which didn't play it. And that was great because we got so much publicity out of it. So, you know, sometimes bad things are turning into great things. And then somebody counted the moaning. I think the New York Times counted 76 moaning, which may be true.
Did you encourage that, Giorgio? Was that something that Donna came up with, or was that your idea to sort of have these suggestive moans in the song?
That was my twisted mind who came up with that idea.
Love to love you, baby. Love to love you, baby.
In fact, at the very beginning, she didn't really have any, just a little bit, but nothing like the end product. And when we did a 17-minute version, I definitely wanted her to do more moaning, but it didn't really work during the recordings because there was her husband was there, Pete Bellotti was there, Jürgen Koppers, the engineer, and I think one or two more friends, so I told everybody to leave the studio. I took all the lights down, and she did the recording. I forgot what happened. She says she claims that she was laying on the floor with a microphone on top. I don't remember. I think she was sitting on a chair, and the lights were really down, and she was obviously comfortable.
It was a fantastic method acting job, in other words, right?
Right, yeah.
We'll continue talking with disco godfather Giorgio Moroder in just a minute here on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. And later, Amy Mann joins forces with Ted Leo.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot, and we've been speaking with longtime producer and performer Giorgio Moroder. He's a name listeners might associate with film scores such as Scarface and Midnight Express, hits like Take My Breath Away, or more recently, a Grammy-winning collaboration with Daft Punk. But for many, it's all about iconic disco tracks like this one, I Feel Love, from the 1977 concept album I Remember Yesterday, recently featured in the Oscar-nominated American Hustle. Giorgio, we were talking about your discovery of the Moog synthesizer. And listening to this song, I'm curious about something fundamental. You were working with these wonderful electronic instruments and these synthesized sounds that sounded like machines. They didn't pretend to imitate real orchestral instruments. That was the big fear at the time. Will we need real musicians and real orchestras anymore if these machines can do it? But no, the machines sounded mechanical. They were a new instrument. Were you going for that intentionally, pairing this organic gospel voice of Donna's with these artificial synthetic sounds? In other words, you know, man meeting machine.
At the beginning, the idea, since we knew that Donna would be able to sing whatever we would propose, we had the idea of doing an album with different sounds. One, the sounds of songs with the sounds of the 50s, the 60s, then songs of the 70s. And I thought we have to have a sound which would reflect or which could become the sound of the future. There was only one instrument, that was the Moog, the big Moog modular, which I didn't use in, I don't think I used it in any of Donna Summer's previous songs. The thing was, I recorded the tracks before I composed them, which is unusual because normally I sit down on the piano, on the guitar, I play the guitar or the piano, and then I, at the same time, I sing and I compose the song. In this case, I played the synthesizers and made the tracks. So when it came to take the tracks down with Donna, I composed it on the spot, and she started to sing with that high voice. Sometimes she would be a little childish, kind of. She would do those little voices like she did in Love to Love You. And it turned out it sounded beautiful because, like you said, this great voice, which was not a big voice, but very interesting voice, and soft and melodic voice, had that big contrast with the metallic sound of the synthesizers.
You know, a lot of people say I Feel Love was one of the first pieces of all electronic music to climb that high in the charts. Jim's hero Brian Eno famously said, "I've heard the sound of the future," and he played the track for Bowie when they were recording in Berlin. Did you hear that story about Eno and Bowie enjoying this track and thinking that it was futuristic and influencing their own work?
Yeah. When I did the soundtrack for Cat People, I worked with David. He sang the song Putting Out the Fire with Gasoline for mm-hmm. the movie. So I think I heard the rumor that he said it, but David definitely confirmed it.
Yeah, that's quite an honor. I mean, these influential artists are saying you're the future of music. I mean, it must have been quite a kick to hear that.
That was my first inkling of maybe I did something interesting.
Well, we are talking to Giorgio Moroder, the composer, the producer, the musical legend. All right, so Giorgio, you know, yes, you're getting attention from people like that. People are excited about your music, your productions. The Donna Summer records are climbing the charts. Was there a period, though, where you were afraid that you were being typecast? Because it became this thing, we got to get that Moroder sound.
Well, it became a problem, and especially that It's relatively cheap to work with synthesizers, right? You don't need a musician. One guy can do everything by himself. So a lot of TV shows, TV movies, where they didn't have the big budgets, they started to use the synthesizers like I used to do them. And I think it became a little overwhelming, like, oh, God, not again that sound.
You were also having your solo career exploding at the same time that you were making all these hits with Donna Summer. I remember talking to some of the Chicago house guys in the 80s, and they were talking about that From Here to Eternity solo album that you put out in 1977. I think you actually had, I think that title song actually was like a number two hit in the United States.
Baby's got me signed.
You also had an Academy Award for the Midnight Express soundtrack from 78. Did you feel that was some of your best work, or was that sort of, I mean, I can't imagine how busy you were at this time producing all these records, composing all this music. How did that sort of stack up in terms of your personal achievements?
Well, that one was an absolutely great project, because I just had I Feel Love went to number one. Alan Parker, the director, thought that would be a great sound for one of the scenes in Midnight Express. He said, okay, Giorgio, just give me one track which reflects a little bit the sound of I Feel Love in the scene where the guy escapes the police, which worked really well for the movie. And then the rest, he said, just do whatever you want. And it was interesting because the request or the job I got to do this a soundtrack was so new to me and so surprising that I wasn't really listening to soundtracks as a musician. I was listening to soundtracks, watching movies like a movie spectator. So I didn't have a clue what to do with the music. I just thought, okay, here we need something more romantic, which there weren't too many things romantic in the movie. Here we need something more dramatic, suspenseful. So I just did it. And I remember Alan Parker came to Munich, where I did the recording, on a Sunday afternoon, and he just loved it. He just said, is there a way to get a little oboe or a little clarinet or some acoustic instrument? And I said, well, look, listen, I play you a few oboes from the synthesizer, and you tell me if you like it, I can put it in. And he liked it. So that was kind of the only comment, and the rest he loved.
You also worked with Blondie, who are huge fans, for that Call Me track from American Gigolo in 1980. Now, how did that come about?
I composed the song, and I had a relatively good demo, which was done with my musicians in Los Angeles. And Paul Schrader and I, we were thinking, and Jerry Bruckheimer, of course, we were thinking, who could do it? And there was only one group, and that was Blondie. So I sent her to Deborah the recording, and just lately, I met her a few months ago in Mexico on a DJ tour, and she said, oh, by the way, do you remember you sent me the demo of Call Me, and you had a title, a rough title, something like Man-Machine, Human-Machine as a title. And it was really funny because it reflected what the character in the movie does, but obviously it didn't work for the song, so she came up with Call Me.
In the legacy of that period of time, when house music, Detroit techno, a lot of these movements, musical movements, taking the innovations of disco, do you think that disco has ever gotten its due? Did you feel you were part of the movement? Did you feel you were standing outside of it? I'm curious about your feelings about that term disco, which for a few years, frankly, you know, was not considered cool. But now it appears to be, well, obviously everybody knows how great it was. What are your feelings about that movement now?
Well, I when disco was in at the beginning, everybody loved it. And I think everybody still loved it after. But, you know, like it became a bad, supposed to be a bad word, but people still would go to the discotheques and dance. And now it's EDM is disco. It's like it's a better, cleaner version of disco, maybe a little less human than then, but it's I love all the sounds, all the disco, the new dance sounds like David Guetta and Avicii and all those guys. If I had those sounds 30 years ago, I would have been the king of dance.
Oh, now wait a minute, Giorgio. So you're talking to two rock critics. There is almost an assembly line of a lot of what, you know, the kids call EDM, electronic dance music. And while there are great people, and the entire time Greg and I are sitting here talking to you, we are flashing on, this is the guy who's on the Daft Punk record, and now he's talking to us, right? All right, you know, obviously, guys like that are just amazing. But there's also a lot of dreck. It's like you turn on the machine, you leave the room, you go outside and have a smoke, you come back, and 20 minutes later, you have a track.
Well, it's true that it's not only the way the synthesizers are used, but the way some of the guys compose, which is kind of give me 8 bars here, give me 8 bars there. But I think from what I'm talking to some people, I think that changes. It's going to change a little bit. I started to work a little bit with David Guetta and Avicii. Mm-hmm. Both guys said, okay, from now on, we want to have songs in the traditional, much more in the traditional way. For example, Avicii with a song "Wake Me Up," that doesn't have anything really to do with EDM. It's almost a country and western song,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So wake me up when it's all over.
You have an intro, you have a verse, you have a pre-chorus, then you have a chorus, then intro again. I mean, a song more in the traditional way.
So the same way that you would start on the acoustic guitar and sketch out a melody. I mean, I know that the guys in Daft Punk could sit down and play much of what's on Random Access Memories for us on an acoustic guitar.
Right, and they did a really good job by getting back with real drums, real strings, guitars, bass, and I remember talking to the guys in Paris where I used to live since last year. Thomas was explaining to me in a ton of words what's the next idea for the album, and finally I realized yeah he's going back to the roots of music. He was telling me, and we're going to use trumpets, we're going to use guitars, which I think they never used real bass. So they did a good job in getting that sound and that feel back of the real recording, but then adding great synthesizer sound.
Were you surprised when they asked you to do that little voiceover thing and it becomes like spoken word on top of one of their tracks?
I wanted to do an album with the sounds of the 50s, the sounds of the 60s, of the 70s, and then have a sound of the future. And I said, wait a second, I know the synthesizer. Why don't I use the synthesizer, which is the sound of the future? And I didn't have any idea what to do, but I knew I needed a click. So we put a click on the 24 track, which then was synced to the Moog modular. I knew that could be a sound of the future, but I didn't realize how much the impact would be. My name is Giovanni Giorgio, but everybody calls me Giorgio. They just told me, why don't you come to the studio in Paris? And they didn't give me any indication what they wanted to do. So I came there and they said, okay, all we need you really is to tell your story and make it as detailed as you can. So I spoke for almost 3 hours. They could really blackmail me with the stuff I told them. I hope they're not going to use it.
That's awesome.
Once you free your mind about a concept of harmony and of music being correct, you can do whatever you want. So nobody told me what to do, and there was no preconception of what to do. And then they played it to me the first time, I think in March, and I was absolutely surprised.
It was quite a moving song. I think they almost paid homage to the I Remember Yesterday album, the way they kind of move through these different eras of music in that song and stitching together your monologue. And you're offering a career summary here in a way, Giorgio, that a couple of sentences near the end. Once you free your mind about a concept of harmony and music being correct, you can do whatever you want. So nobody told me what to do, and there was no preconception of what to do. It seems like that's the Giorgio Moroder career in a couple of sentences, right?
In fact, that happened in several times, but especially on I Feel Love. I had zero in front of me except this huge, whatever looked like a telephone switching board. And I just said, okay, there's only one way to start. You have to take down a click so you can sync up all the synthesizers. And I told Tommy, give me a bass. So he gave, after like 5 minutes, he had a nice little bass, and I could program the bass in the four notes, dong, 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 dong. I could program them, and then by triggering the click, it would play the speed which I wanted, dong, 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 dong. So I chose, 125 or something like that. And so I recorded, dong, 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 dong. And every 8 bars, I had to stop, tune the thing again, restart. And then based on that one, it's kind of a little mathematical, because I did not have the melody, so I started 4 bars here. Okay, now let's do 8 bars here. Okay, then let's 4, and then let's 6, and then about again 4. Because I didn't have the melody. And then I added all the sounds. We created, it's called the white noise. And you cut it, and you get the sounds of a snare, of a hi-hat, of several percussions. And then, so there was no, the concept came up while I was producing the tracks. And then the melody came later on anyway. Mm.
Well, Giorgio, is there anything up your sleeve? Are you working on anything next?
Oh, I'm working like crazy. I did a lot of remixes lately. I start with a great group or a good girl from New York called Class Actress. I'm preparing some stuff for an album, which I'm going to do soon, as soon as I have the deal. So I'm back. I'm back working now.
We've been talking with producer and recording artist Giorgio Moroder here on Sound Opinions. Giorgio, it's been a real pleasure.
Okay, thank you very much.
For a list of some of Giorgio's best tracks, visit soundopinions.org. And we want to hear from you. What are your memories of Giorgio Moroder's work in the disco era and beyond? And what do you think about the difference between disco and modern electronic dance music? Call 888-859-1800. Coming up on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX, Amy Mann comes together with Ted Leo for The Both.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and that's a track called Milwaukee from a new collaboration between Amy Mann and Ted Leo called The Both. Self-titled debut album out now. Amy Mann was in the band till Tuesday in the 80s, of course, and had that big hit Voices Carry, went solo in the 90s, 8 solo albums, most recently Charmer in 2012, founded her own record label, Super Ego. Many people would know her from that soundtrack for Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia. She was nominated for a Grammy and an Oscar Award, and that really established her as one of the key indie artists and singer-songwriters of the last 15 years. Ted Leo, in many ways, a counterpart, moving in parallel movements throughout that two-decade period that Amy Mann was establishing her name. He came out of the punk and hardcore scene in New Jersey and New York in the late 80s, early 90s, and he's played in numerous bands. I think the best-known and longest-lasting one has been Ted Leo and the Pharmacists. They've had 9 albums, most recently in 2010. They came out with The Brutalist Bricks. Now, he's also been a consistent presence as a solo performer, and it was as a solo act that he and Amy Mann started collaborating together. She saw him perform and said, hey, we should do some stuff together. That resulted in a tour last year. They began working on new material, and now we have a collaborative album called The Both. Here's a track from it called Volunteers of America from The Both on Sound Opinions.
The contract's a joke, but when you see smoke, you run toward the fire cause you must. And they all called your name when the crash finally came and left you to pick up the dust. I saw you walking in silence down to the bridge, but nothing went over the side. So I guess to someone with your heritage, withdrawal like consent is implied. And it's true.
Makes you
That was Volunteers of America from the self-titled debut by the both Amy Mann and Ted Leo. Greg, we started with a little bit up top of the song Milwaukee from that album, and I think that is the worst song on the album. It also was the kind of pre-advanced streaming single. Ted and Amy were touring together. They were walking around Milwaukee, where you went to college. Nothing against Milwaukee. It's a fine burg, right? And they see the Arthur Fonzarelli statue, and they begin to muse about it. But then there's also this chorus about a nucleus splitting apart. I have no idea what they were talking about. It's a bad song. Critics make a fatal mistake when they review the album or the movie or the book that they wish an artist had made instead of the one in front of them. I'll tell you what I was hoping for from this collaboration. Mann is a genius in terms of portraying beautifully in unforgettable songs Heartbreak, while Leo has been a non-preachy, idealistic political voice of consciousness, very much a modern inheritor of what The Clash was. I thought this would be a political album of great pop songs where the two were just on fire about things making them angry. Instead, it's a pretty typical set. It's half Mann and half Leo. What we like about both of them, the voices merge smoothly. They clearly inspire each other as writers to dig a little deeper for the better hook, to go a little better for the great lyric. It's just a collection of good songs. Now, that's enough if I hadn't been expecting more, and I love both of these artists, right? And I'll say it's not as good an album as Charmer. Amy Mann's 2012 disc was just a masterpiece. This is simply a very good record, and I love about half of it. I expect better from these two. I will give it a try it.
You sound so half-hearted about a collection of good songs, like that's a bad thing or something. I know exactly what both of these artists have done in the past, and that's what made me intrigued about the idea of them collaborating. Like, they really don't have a lot in common, or at least I didn't think they did. What they've done is created a third entity, and that's a beautiful thing. The idea that these two can collaborate and do something they really haven't done before in uniting their songwriting styles. And they have created a union here.
Amy has worked with her husband, Michael Penn, and it's not that different from this.
Well, Ted Leo's more of a punk rocker than Michael Penn ever was. The point being that they function like a band on this record, which I was very surprised by. To me, the one common link is that they both put an emphasis on those good songs, as you say. I would say some even great songs on this record. Their love of melody, the well-constructed arrangement, you know, an emotional foundation built around those arrangements. Leo impressed me as a guitar player on this record in showing me different styles and textures that he could bring to underline the emotions in many of these songs, and that's a beautiful thing. I would say 90% of the songs on this record really work on a collaborative level to the point where I can't say, oh, that's an Amy song or that's a Ted song. It's a song by the both. It's a band effort, and that's a wonderful thing. It's a buy-it record for me.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
As often as possible on Sound Opinions, we like to swim out to the desert island, pop a quarter in the desert island jukebox, and play a song we cannot live without. Jim, this week it's your turn.
Greg, back in January, we did a show called The Bermuda Triangle. We were talking about bands for which we had very high hopes that then proceeded to disappear, and we never heard from them again. I was thinking of my album of the year from 2009, Ida Maria, this young firebrand from Norway who made this fantastic record that was a cross between new wave pop melodies from the 80s and punk rock aggression. That album was called Fortress Round My Heart. Came out in 2008 in Ida Maria Borli Sivertsen's native Norway. Came over 2009 via Mercury Records, and she made a big splash at Lollapalooza that year. And then where the heck did she go? Nowhere. So I'm researching her for that Bermuda Triangle show. It turns out that she put out a second album in 2010 called Catla. It's a little slicker than the debut, a little less punk, a little more glam rock 70s, which is not a bad thing, and a little, and I generally dislike this genre, a little show tune, a little like musical, but it's very funny stuff. It's like when Bjork was doing that. The song I'm going to play is typical. It's 10,000 Lovers, and it's her bragging about her accomplishments, but in the middle of it, unlike the rest of her canon, she begins to rant in a sort of spoken word speech in her native Norwegian. I have no idea what she's saying, but I so love the way she's saying it. It's like irresistible. Only the last two words make any sense. She's just ranting a million miles a minute, and then the last two words are,
Frank Sinatra! Whatever preceded that has to be great. This is Ida Maria, 10,000 Lovers, a Desert Island Jukebox pick for Sound Opinions. That was Ida Maria with 10,000 Lovers from her second album, Catla, on Sound Opinions. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Jim, I know you've had Dancing Queen on repeat on your smartphone for the last week.
Yes.
In celebration of ABBA's 40th anniversary, and that's what we're going to do next week.
Greg, as always, we have some thank yous to say on the way out. Sound Opinions is produced by Robin Lynn, Jason Saldana, Anthony Martinez, and our intern, Jake Smith. And Greg, one more news note on the way out, just in time for the Easter season. Did you hear there's going to be an all-star production of Jesus Christ Superstar featuring members of Destiny's Child, NSYNC, Incubus, and, get this, Johnny Rotten as Herod.
Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling goes a telephone. Ting-a-ling, a-ling-a-ling-a goes my heart. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling goes a telephone, and I know that the fireworks will start.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline, 888-859-1800.
New messages.
Hey, Jim and Greg, this is Mando. I'm in Berlin. I just heard your Allman Brothers special, and I really appreciate these special episodes. I've learned so much about different genres and bands that I had never gotten into before through you guys. And generally, whenever you guys have one of these, I always end up getting interested and feel like I'm going to get more into the band that you guys talked about. But man, couldn't get less interested in the Allman Brothers. I feel like the whole time I couldn't connect them by anything. It just felt like jamming the whole time through. I hope that other listeners got more out of it than I did. Sorry to be so negative. Love your show. Talk to you guys later.
Hey, guys. This is Josh in Oakland. Just heard the review of the Black Lips album.
And you guys were talking about bands that were influenced by the Beatles and then were kind of doing a garage rock thing where they were trying to sound like the Beatles but came up with their own sound. And it kind of made me think of bands like Big Star, which are, you know, a great example of that.
There's people around who tell you that they know the places where to send you, and it's easy to go.
And then I just discovered the other day Jay and the Americans to be a little bit like that as well, kind of a mix of, you know, Roy Orbison meets the Beatles meets Richie Valens' La Bamba. Thanks very much.
Hey, guys. My name is Rui Barreto from Chicago. Wanted to say I was very impressed by your interview and the performance of Pelican, one of the better modern metal bands around today. However, I was surprised that they didn't talk about the influence of, I'm sure, what was probably their favorite band in this genre growing up, which is Tool, who absolutely used the same method of songwriting and song performances, both live and in the studio. And if Maynard Keene's vocals weren't on those songs, they would be exactly the type of long suites and symphonies, you could call them, that Pelican uses.
So good to see you once again. I thought that you were hiding. You thought that I had run away. Chasing the tail of a dog.
I'm surprised that they didn't talk about that influence. Love your show, and I listen every week.
Hi, this is Todd from Western Springs, Illinois. I just heard your interview with Pelican, and I wanted to say thank you for that. As a family man with a 9-to-5, who is also a songwriter who's been having a go at it for 20 years or so, it was really, really nice to hear a bunch of guys who've had success talking about the fact of trying to balance the real life with their music life. Good show, great interview. Thanks for keeping the dream alive.
No more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.